Welcome to CL Talk, the leading podcast for the legal profession across Canada, brought to you by Canadian Lawyer Magazine. I'm Tim Wilbur, the managing editor of Canadian Lawyer Magazine. Today, I'm speaking with Arif Virani, the Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada. Minister Virani has been in this role since 2023 and was first elected to Parliament in 2015. Before that, he worked as a government lawyer in Ontario's Ministry of the Attorney General. Welcome, Minister Virani.
Thank you very much for having me, Tim.
I know our listeners and readers will be quite interested to hear from you and hear about what you're working on. But before we get into your current role, if you can tell me a bit about your career before you joined politics and then what led up to you becoming the Minister of Justice.
Certainly. So I'm a McGill undergrad graduate of poli-sci history, a U of T law grad. And after graduating from U of T, I worked for a few years on Bay Street at Fasken Martineau, doing commercial litigation work. I also was the recipient of a scholarship barrister's training in England. So that's called the Fox Scholarship. So I did some training as a barrister at Middle Temple in England, which is quite formative. And then a few years into my career as associate at Faskins, I made the switch over to working as a Crown Counsel. And you mentioned that in the intro. So I was working at the Attorney General of Ontario's office in the Constitutional Law Branch, where I was doing litigation work that related to the Charter, the Division of Powers, providing legal advice, but also arguing cases in all courts, all levels of court right around the country. Sorry. So I did that for about 12 years until putting my name in the ring to run for office in 2015.
Great. And just one more question on your sort of lead up. What drove you to decide to go into politics? Sounds like your role was sort of related to what you're now doing. So it was a natural shift, or what made you make that decision?
Well, it was a few things. It was an impressionable book I read about the Prime Minister's father when I was a young man, about the age of 16 or 17. I read a book about Pierre Trudeau that sort of piqued my interest in maybe one day running for office. I also was confronted with some of the legal work I was doing, both as Crown Counsel, but also sort of extracurricular legal work. In particular, I helped to create a legal clinic in Ontario called the South Asian Legal Clinic of Ontario, SALCO. And that was a great idea by a bunch of sort of late 20-year-olds and early 30-year-olds. We got it up and running, but it took about 9 years. And I think I realized through that process that it might have gone a bit faster had we had an ally on the inside, particularly at the decision-making table, like the cabinet table. And I thought, well, maybe we need an ally on the inside and I should be that ally. And then the last two things were sort of pragmatic, which were that I had an affiliation for the Liberal Party, but there were some concerns about leaders for the Liberal Party. There was a time when there were many leaders over a course of a short amount of time. And when Justin Trudeau took over, I was comfortable with him. And I thought he had presented an opportunity for the Liberal Party to return to governing the country. And lastly, in 2014, I just wasn't happy with the government that was representing me. And I've always been honest about that. And I think some people decide to cast a ballot or make a donation or maybe volunteer for a campaign. I decided if I wanted to change the government, I should be part of that change and put my name on a ballot. So that's why I decided to do so in 2014 to try and change the government. And that's what we were successful in doing.
Great. And before we get into, because I have lots of questions about the justice portfolio, but before we get into that, can you tell me a bit about from that point when you ran to what you've done now, because you've had various roles in the government, but this is the most prominent role you've had so far.
Sure. And I've been very fortunate to have been given the nod from the Prime Minister to take on quite a few different tasks. So I came here as a Ugandan refugee in 1972 at the tender age of one. And the first thing the Prime Minister asked me to do is assist John McCallum as his parliamentary secretary of the Syrian refugee resettlement. So that's what I occupied myself with for the first year and a half of my parliamentary career. And it was an amazing experience. You can imagine it's very much coming full circle for a refugee themselves to be assisting the next wave of refugees 42 years later. Quite amazing. And after that, I was given the nod to be the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Heritage, where I got to work on issues that relate to promoting multiculturalism, but also on Indigenous language protection, not something I ever thought I would ever touch as a parliamentarian. And it turned out to be one of the most rewarding files I've ever touched. It really gave me a sense of sort of historic injustices and how much work that needs to be done on reconciliation. I then served as Parliamentary Secretary to two Ministers of Justice. So that was right up my alley as a constitutional and human rights lawyer. So I served under Jody Wilson-Raybould and under David Lametti as both of their parliamentary secretaries. And that proved to be sort of quite fortuitous in terms of the background I got, the knowledge of the officials, the way the department works. It's boded me well these last 9 months that I've been in this office. And that was most recently Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of International Trade, which gave me an international dimension to my work. So all of those responsibilities, I think, just gave me a good background and understanding of how Ottawa operates, how the government operates, both external-facing international work, domestic-facing work, and a lot of legal work. So I was always using my legal brain, which helped, because I'm using it a lot right now as minister, that's for sure.
Great. So I'm going to dive right into it. As we spoke about before we started recording, the one thing, you know, I spoke with various lawyers across the country and asked them what they wanted to ask you. And the unanimous thing was about judicial nominations. That's obviously something that lawyers are on the front lines. They can see the effect of the lack of judges across the country and the vacancies. So currently, as far as I'm aware, that there's approximately 65 vacancies across Canada at the federal level judicial positions. So can you talk a bit about whether that number consistent with yours and what your government is doing right now to address those vacancies?
So the current number of vacancies as of today, the day we're speaking, is 61. And we're doing a great deal. And this has been honestly one of my top priorities since taking office, because I feel this is very much sort of the bread and butter or meat and potatoes part of my job, is that we need to be appointing judges of the highest caliber, but also judges that represent the diversity of this country. And I'll say to you, so far, what I've been able to do is I've appointed personally 92 judges myself. In the last 12 months, a combination of myself and David Lametti have appointed 122 judges. And just to give you some comparison, the government that I sought to replace back in 2015, the average number of appointments annually for that government was 65. So on that metric, we're working at a pace that is almost twice the pace of the previous government. That being said, I mean, your audience is about just scrutinizing Canadian lawyers, and I'm one of those scrutinizing Canadian lawyers, and that doesn't mean that the pace is necessarily as brisk as it needs to be. So what are we doing to keep up the pace? So I'll tell you quite candidly what I've been doing. So I gathered my team right away on the political side, and I said, you know, how are we dealing with the applications, and do we need more staff? And I added to the staff in terms of my political staff that deal with judicial vacancies. I also said, how do we diagnose what's increasing the length of time? One thing I heard about was security checks, interestingly enough. And we made two targeted changes to security checks to speed them up. One is that an individual, Tim Wilbur, if they were to apply right now, would now apply with the comprehensive evaluation form, but submit their security clearance form right now. We're not going to wait for it later on. We're going to do things simultaneously to speed things up. So that's important. Secondly, is that I worked with the Privy Council Office and my own department, the Department of Justice, to sort of say, all things considered, I've got a constitutional imperative to appoint judges and meet the requirements of not causing delays that might go outside of Jordan. Therefore, I don't think my applicants should be treated the same way as an application, with all due respect, to the Port Authority in Vancouver, or an application to a registrar's office in Halifax, etc. Until I made that intervention, they were literally treating all security applications as same, whether it's for a judicial vacancy or for some other vacancy. That's changed under my watch. That's a good thing. We also said for the judicial appointments committees, the JACs, we said that they're going to run for 3 years instead of two, because some of the JACs were lapsing. And when they lapse, that creates a sort of a void, a gap in time when cases are being considered or applications are being considered. And lastly, the change that I made was that it used to be an individual Tim Wilbur's application would, if they were assessed, that assessment would only last for 2 years of time. Now it lasts for 3 years, so there's a longer window for an application to be sitting there, potentially for me to appoint. Your audience should know that I protect myself and our government by never appointing somebody who is not recommended by a JAC. So a JAC will say to the individual, Tim Wilbur, sorry, I already pick on you. Tim is unrecommended, recommended, or highly recommended. I only look at recommended or highly recommended because I think that it gives some integrity to the process. So those are the things I've been working on. And I honestly, I'm a bit of a pain in the rear end for my staff in terms of how frequently I interrogate them on how many more are we getting next week? Like, what is it looking like? What do you need me to do? And my staff kind of jokes around if I take longer than about 45 or 60 minutes to review a set of applications, because I review them quickly. And I do so because I understand the urgency. It's literally a constitutional priority, and it's a very high priority for me.
Great. So you went through various elements there. Some of our readers and listeners will be more familiar with the process of the details of it, some less. So I wanted to step back a bit and look at the Judicial Advisory Committee. I think that's about that, how it's composed. And you mentioned some changes to how you work with them. So can you tell me a bit about how it's composed and whether you're looking at changing anything in that part of the process? And also, once you get the recommendations you mentioned, how quickly they go through your review. And I would assume they also go to the PMO's office as well. So it's sort of like a three-step process in that sense, from a very broad level. So first question, the JAC committee, are you looking at any changes there, how they operate? And then how does things work once they go past your office to the PMO?
Well, one thing that I'd say to you is that on top of the two changes that I mentioned, which is the length of time a JAC sits and the length of the duration for which their evaluation endures, what I've also done is I've convened meetings of the JACs. And this hadn't been done for about 4 or 5 years. So I actually convened all of the chairs of the judicial appointments committees around the country. And we had a Zoom chat. And I emphasized to them the importance of the work they do, but also the importance of the speed at which they do their work. I've also written to them and asked them to meet frequently, including as frequently as monthly, when there is a backlog of applications for which they need to deal with. So that's me sort of putting my foot on the gas in terms of encouraging the JACs to do their work quickly. In terms of sort of changes to the composition, we made those changes all the way back in 2015. And the way it sits right now is that you've got members of the JAC, there are 8 members of a JAC. So one is the representative from the Law Society. Another is a representative named by the CBA. Another representative is named by the Chief Justice. A fourth person is named by the Provincial Attorney General. You've got 3 government nominees, so that's from our end on the federal government, and you've got 1 ex officio non-voting member, so that's somebody who comes out of the Commissioner of Judicial Affairs office. That composition is important. We try to also ensure that it's a diverse composition because we're trying to ensure both high-quality jurists that are coming through the process and ensuring that they represent the diversity of this country. I've been very active in doing that in terms of sort of on a traveling roadshow around the country. So whether it's in Vancouver or Halifax or anywhere in between, from coast to coast to coast, I frequently engage with bar associations. And I'll say quite openly to the people that are listening now, if you think you have the aptitude and capacity to do this, I encourage you to look at the application, to fill out the application, and to submit an application. You need to be of 10 years of call. But I find that sometimes people need a gentle nudge to put in an application, and I'm providing that nudge all over the country, including with groups like Indigenous Bar Associations, Canadian Association of Black Lawyers, South Asian Bar Association, you name it. It's really, really critical for me to get the word out amongst those communities, the Federation of Asian Canadian Lawyers as well. So that's really important, and that's in terms of sort of creating that deep applicant pool. But in terms of sort of changing the composition of the JACs, what we're trying to do is ensure that the JACs, as currently constituted, remain vibrant and are sitting regularly. And if a JAC has expired, that we replace it very, very quickly. So there are a few that have expired in one part of Quebec, in Alberta and Manitoba. Manitoba has no vacancies, but the Quebec and the Alberta ones, I hope to have good news for you soon with respect to the reconstitution of both of those JACs. Because any extended time lag for the existence of a judicial appointments committee can cause delays further down the line. And that's what we're trying to address. The last part of your question dealt with sort of how many offices. So it does go from the judicial appointments committee to my office, then to the prime minister's office. You need to ultimately have all appointments ratified through cabinet. So those steps are of necessity. But I think it's also important to understand that I can only work as fast as there are cabinet scheduled meetings, right? So we've had recent instances where people have commented on time lags and delays during times such as COVID. Well, during COVID included 2021. And during 2021, there was a 5-month period where there was a federal election where we didn't have cabinet meetings. That, by necessity, delays the process of making judicial appointments. So I think these are things that people have to take into consideration when they're evaluating what's causing a delay at a given point in time.
Okay, great. And just in terms of the stats, you mentioned the number of vacancies. You know, Canada's population is growing as well very quickly. So even how you measure, how you state how many vacancies there are, I assume presumes a certain population, and that can change as well. So how do you look at those numbers as well?
So we try and do a calibration in terms of sort of where the needs are, and we try to be attentive to those needs. It requires provinces to give us a business case about what they're thinking in terms of the needs expanding. I will note that there are now 995 judges at the federal level around the country, at superior courts around the country. 116 of those positions were created by our government since 2015. So we've been supple. You may have noted in budget 2024, we took the decision after 6 years in which Alberta had decided not to use an allocation of what's called a unified family court judge. They were allocated 17 in Alberta back in 2018, originally because they asked for them. Then they decided they weren't able to use them. We talked to them about it on repeated occasions, wrote to them about it on repeated occasions, and they indicated they could not use those spots. So we've taken them and we're repurposing them and reallocating them to other parts of the country where there are acute judicial vacancy needs. So that's important in terms of showing that flexibility that we need to show, but also being attentive to the business case that might be presented by any part of the country, whether that's sort of in the central part of the country where I am, Ontario and Quebec, or whether that's on the prairies, the further west or further east. So that's really, really important in terms of what we're trying to do. But I guess I'd also just encourage people, again, those scrutinizing lawyers that are listening to us, to just understand it's not, the math on vacancies is not particularly linear. And the best I can do is give you an example. In the calendar year of 2023, we started the calendar year of 2023 on January 1st with 89 vacancies. Myself and David Lametti, that calendar year in 2023, appointed 100 people, right? Notwithstanding that we appointed 100 people, we ended the year with 78 vacancies. So we only made a dent of 11 from 89 to 78 in terms of the number of vacancies. Why? Well, that's because some people retired and retirements we're able to predict. But a lot more judges went supernumerary, which is that part-time status where they sit half-time, but they're considered a vacancy. And it is hard to predict. We know when somebody's eligible for supernumerary status, but we don't know whether they're actually going to choose supernumerary status. And that has been a phenomenon that I've been observing more and more. And I'll say to you that that's one of the things that becomes difficult to sort of keep up with the ongoing demand. So if you could appoint 100 judges and only make a dent of 11 in terms of bringing down vacancies from 89 to 78, you realize that there are other factors at work. And I know, I guess that begs the question, well, you've got to keep up with those other factors, and we're trying to do so as best as possible. And that includes appointing judges at a rate, as I mentioned 10 minutes ago, which is twice as fast as the previous government. And that's what I'll continue to do, because you don't get to this role without being a type A lawyer who likes success. And that's what I'm trying to do, is be as successful as possible in getting these appointments done.
And obviously the numbers is really important, but diversity also is a big thing for judiciary as well. So I have a very specific question, and then more broadly, what are you doing? I know obviously it's each individual appointment will reflect your commitment to diversity, but are there other sort of broader things that you're looking at, or how you're assessing the need for diversity in the judiciary as well?
Well, certainly. And I'll say to you quite candidly that when I have the pleasant opportunity to contact people, and I've contacted 92 people so far to either elevate them or to appoint them for the first time, I talk to them about the justice system, and I talk about the administration of justice and ensuring that it is held in high repute and the Canadians have confidence in it. And I do firmly believe in my core, and this is echoed by the Prime Minister, that Canadians' confidence in the administration of justice is enhanced when they see themselves reflected on the bench. I firmly believe that. And I would say look no further than the last three Supreme Court appointments. Those last three appointments include the first Indigenous person on the bench, Madam Justice Ombudsman, the first racialized person, Mr. Justice Jamal. And now with Mary Moreau, we now have five women on a panel of nine at the Supreme Court of Canada. It's the first time we have a majority of women in the Supreme Court's history, and it may be a first internationally for any G7 country. That's notable, but I think that starts at the top. It doesn't end at the top. We're trying to do that with courts of appeal around the country and superior courts around the country. And I'm quite proud of the fact that we are appointing racialized candidates, for example, at a higher rate under my short time as minister than we've done in the past. So the stats just on that are that we've appointed 15% of the judges have been racialized individuals since 2015 that we've appointed. For me, that number climbs to 21%. And we can say the same for people who are LGBTQ2. We're working on persons with disability, Indigenous persons, and also bilingualism. And I say this all the time to people. Your bilingualism is not just an asset at the Supreme Court of Canada. Your bilingualism is an asset when I've got a vacancy in Saskatchewan or or in Nova Scotia. This is an asset everywhere we look. So please, if there's a message to send out there to your listeners, is that consider applying and don't hesitate to keep working on your French, right? Lifelong learning is a good thing for all of us as lawyers. But it is really, really critical. And I'll just reiterate what I said earlier, Tim, is that I make it very intentional when I'm out and about in this country to talk to groups of lawyers, including diverse lawyers and diverse bar associations, about the importance of helping me in this endeavor to diversify our judiciary, because I do feel it enhances Canadians' confidence when they see those who mete out justice in their communities reflect those actual communities.
Right. And you kind of led me to my next specific question about the Supreme Court. You mentioned the recent appointments, the diversity and whatnot, but there still is quite a vocal segment of the Indigenous community that feels that the bilingual requirement is a major impediment to appointing qualified Indigenous judges. So is there any openness to reconsidering that in any way for the Supreme Court or for the, you know, it's a convention, it's not a legal requirement. So what's your view on that?
Yeah, so this policy comes from the top, right? So the Prime Minister Trudeau was the one who envisaged this back when he first started as the leader of the country. And he has stuck by it in respect of all of the appointments he has made to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I think it's an important policy. I think it's one that reflects the need for a national court to represent our two national official languages. And we've managed to both do that and have Indigenous representation on the Supreme Court of Canada in Madam Justice Avanceman. So what I would say to people that aspire to that level is that if you're really gunning for one of the top jobs in Canada in terms of being on the Supreme Court of Canada, that under this government, the requirement to be effectively bilingual and to be able to hear and listen and understand submissions without the use of an interpretive device is something that is very much a priority for Prime Minister Trudeau and will remain so.
Well, thank you. So I think that's all my questions on judicial nominations. But now I want to talk more broadly about your legislative priorities in other areas. So, you know, Trudeau has had some very big legislative achievements earlier in his term, cannabis legislation, legalization, that kind of thing. Is there anything of that nature, a large legislative priorities that you can point to that you want to achieve in your term as AG?
Certainly. Well, I'd say to you that there's three things that are sort of on the table in the House of Commons right now. And I think I'd like to see all of those across the finish line. But the really fundamental one is a bill called Bill C-63. Bill C-63 deals with online harms and online safety. And this is a piece of legislation that we spent about 3+ years in consultation on. And it really fundamentally deals with the idea about duties on social media platforms in terms of the content they're hosting, duties to keep children safe, duties to remove certain content, and duties to act responsibly. And that's really, really quite sort of era defining. You've seen a progression in terms of some of our actions with respect to social media companies, in terms of financing, in terms of supporting local media, et cetera, local journalism. But this is really about fundamentally about keeping Canadians safe, which I feel like is one of my fundamental priorities as Minister of Justice and as Attorney General. And it's about ensuring that there's actually a takedown requirement on certain types of material. That includes two of the seven categories where there would be a takedown requirement, and that those two categories are child sexual abuse material and what we call revenge porn, so the non-consensual sharing of intimate images. But there's five other categories of material that deal with incitements to violence, incitements to terrorism, hatred, things like bullying a child and also inducing a child to self-harm. And now I'm speaking to you not just as a parliamentarian and as the Minister of Justice, but also as a father. I think there's nothing more fundamental than keeping our children safe. And this is fundamentally what this bill is all about. So I'm very keen on ensuring that we have debate on this bill, that we get it into committee, that we make amendments that might be needed to the bill. But it is really, really a fundamental importance when you've got children, tragically, who get preyed upon by sexual predators, tragically, who also resort to suicide because they are so intimidated by having made one mistake and shared an image with somebody who they thought was a fellow gamer on Fortnite and turns out to be a predator in some East European country who's 50 years old, who now starts extorting them for money. And I'm not making stuff like this up. It's unfortunately happening quite regularly. And we've had some pretty well-covered and well-documented suicides of teenagers that have occurred in BC and other provinces just in the last several months. So that's what I'm putting a lot of emphasis on in terms of my work. There's other work that I'm doing on Indigenous reconciliation that relates to a non-derogation clause to the Interpretation Act, which is fundamentally about ensuring Aboriginal and treaty rights are protected the way we interpret Indigenous, the way we interpret federal legislation. And the last piece of the bill called C-40. And what I'll say to you is that I'm very seized with the overrepresentation we have in the justice system and in the correction system of Indigenous and Black Canadians. And we're working on strategies to reduce that overrepresentation and have been doing so for a while. But there's one bill that's already in Parliament that relates to exactly this. It's called the Miscarriage of Justice Review Commission. And what it would do is that it would take this responsibility out of my office and dedicate the task to a neutral commission that seeks out cases that might involve wrongful convictions and brings them to the fore and makes the decision about ultimately whether a new trial or a new appeal has to follow. This is a model that's already used in the United Kingdom. And Tim, what I'd say to you quite shockingly is that in the last 22, 23 years, we've had 27 wrongful convictions in this country. In the same time period, there's been 500 in the UK. It can't be that the UK is getting things wrong so much more frequently than we are. In fact, I think it's the opposite. We're not finding the wrong cases in our own system. And what further troubled me is that among those 27 cases, 22 involved white men and 5 involved Indigenous or Black individuals. We know with the overrepresentation in our correction system that is statistically improbable. What it likely means is that Black and Indigenous people are not don't have the resources or the wherewithal to sort of make their case about their wrongful conviction. This new commission would actually go and seek out those cases, provide resources, even address reach people in their languages, whether that might be an Indigenous language. That's an outreach effort that we need to have in this country to cure what I think should be everyone's priority, which is ensuring that someone who is wrongfully convicted doesn't languish in a Canadian prison. So these are the things that I'm concerned about and that I'll continue to work on and continue to prioritize, all at the same time keeping up this brisk pace of appointing judges, because there's a lot of judges that I still need to appoint, and I'm very committed to doing exactly that.
Right. And there's a few more legislative issues, I guess, that I heard from lawyers about in various stages of development or not in Ottawa. So I'll list them and you can tell me if you want to speak to where things are on any of them. I don't know if you'll want to speak to all of them. So you've already mentioned a few, but MAID was a big one that we had some questions about, you know, what the status of that legislation is. There's a lot of questions arising through that. Gun control, what's the status of that? There was a retreat, I guess, from some of the ways that firearms were classified under the legislation. Car thefts is a big issue. There's a big question about how that's being dealt with at the border in terms of, you know, the border control. And then more broadly, there's mental health in the justice system and domestic violence. So I've thrown a whole bunch of things at you. Pick which one you think is something that you can speak to, that you have specific plans that you can, Canadians will see in the next, during your tenure.
Sure. So thank you. So on domestic violence, what I'd say is that people should look at sort of both what I've been saying and also what our government's been investing in. So in domestic violence, particularly what we call intimate partner violence, I've been quite clear in the wake of a pretty notorious coroner's inquest here in Ontario about calling the rash of intimate partner violence an epidemic in this country. And we've actually got behind a bill that would amend legislation to create a course of control offense in this country. Again, that's following on the heels of such legislation that's been passed in other parts of the world, including in the UK. So that's really, really important. In terms of medical assisted in dying, what I would say to you is that people would know that we passed a legislation just this spring to extend out the temporary suspension on being made available to those where mental illness is the sole underlying condition. That will be addressed in a future parliament by March of 2027. But it still remains to be considered a couple of other areas about things such as advanced directives and whether those can be applied to the MAID regime as we have it now. And also the idea about mature minors, whether somebody under the age of 18 could be in a position to provide their consent for the administration of MAID. On auto theft, I'll be very clear on this, and I think it's very notable because it's certainly a continuing concern for my government, and I hear about it from my constituents, as do my fellow parliamentary colleagues. What we've done in the last sort of couple of months is that we've made very significant investments dollar-wise in terms of law enforcement and in terms of border controls. So about almost $200 million has been dedicated towards the Montreal port and its safety and security, towards Interpol, and also towards law enforcement in Ontario and Quebec in particular, because that seems to be the sort of ground zero of the auto theft as it's occurring. It's occurring elsewhere, but in the main, it's occurring in those two provinces, towards assisting the enforcement at a local level by police officers. What I'd say is interesting is that those results are bearing fruit. We've had about 600 seizures of automobile vehicles by CBSA at the Port in Montreal in the last about 4 or 5 weeks. But we're also seeing, and CBC was just reporting on this, is that there is a domestic sale of auto stolen vehicles that is also happening in this country right now. And that requires our focus to be somewhat redirected, because what's happening is that there's things like, such as re-vinning that's happening. So the vehicle identification number is removed and a new vehicle identification number is put on. And now that stolen vehicle becomes quote-unquote legitimate for sale. That's a whole nother kettle of fish that doesn't relate to the border and our enforcement requirements at the border. It relates to domestic things. And I've raised this with the Premier of Ontario because one of the things that we've been looking at is Service Ontario in my province deals with the vinning of vehicles, et cetera. There's been a privatization of services at Service Ontario. So is that contributing or not to this phenomenon? How can we curtail that kind of fraud? And there was a fraud expose at one Service Ontario location in the Toronto region just in the last 6 or 8 weeks or so. So there's multiple ways of addressing the auto theft piece, but you should know for those, again, those discerning lawyers that are listening to the podcast, Budget 2024 talks about those investments that we made, but also about amendments to the criminal code that I will be proposing through the Budget Implementation Act to look at who's orchestrating this. And what I mean by that is that there's an organized criminality component. This is gone are the days of the joyride by the random sort of teenager sort of doing this on a lark. This is an orchestrated phenomenon that is being orchestrated in Canada with international links. So we're proposing to target the organized criminality component of it, to look at aggravating factors and to increase maximum penalties. That's important. And another thing that's important is that I think people should be crystal clear that if you want to get tough with organized crime, you've also got to deal with money laundering and proceedings and unlawful financial activities that arise from the proceeds of crime. We've had legislation on the books since on the floor of the House of Commons since the fall economic statement that has been opposed vociferously by His Majesty's official opposition. We've got a further set of initiatives on money laundering that is included in the Budget Implementation Act. And the leader of the official opposition has unfortunately declared his opposition to that bill in its entirety. So there are steps that we are taking. We're trying to take that with a fully unanimous parliament, but we're being impeded from doing so. So I'm very active on that front because, again, as I said earlier, whether it's online safety, whether it's auto theft safety, my job fundamentally is about keeping Canadians safe, ensuring the justice system can do that. And that's what I'm prioritizing.
Well, thank you. I really threw a laundry list of things at you at the end there. So thank you for providing some context for some of those legislative initiatives. I think we're running out of time, so I'd love to ask you many more questions, and so would our readers and listeners, but we appreciate the time you've given us. So thank you so much, and we look forward to hearing more about all the work that you're doing in your office.
Thank you very much, Tim. And I just had you mentioned mental health, and I just say, you know, you can couple some of the initiatives I was talking about. When we talk about online hate and online safety, the pernicious impacts that it's having on people's sense of inclusion, sense of belonging, sense of safety actually impacts their mental health. So sometimes these things work in conjunction. So there's investments on the healthcare side into mental health, but there's also curing a lack of sort of sensibility and security in the online spaces. And we've seen the U.S. Surgeon General comment on exactly that, that what's happening with young people and how they're being targeted by certain social media applications is having a detrimental impact on their mental health. So these are things we're working at in concert. But thank you very much for having me. I love Canadian Lawyer Magazine, and it's an honor to be a guest on your show here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara.
Thank you for tuning in to CL Talk. You can listen to the latest episodes on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, and all major listening channels. Just search for CL Talk.